It's 6 minutes after 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This hour, we're going to talk about the airline industry. A couple of recent news items make this topic certainly worth our time. First, of course, the safety issue. When a Southwest Airlines Boeing 737 suddenly had a rip in its skin, forcing an emergency landing, that set off a cascade of inspections and the grounding of many planes. Second, a new report on airline performance suggests that airlines are doing a better job of things like landing on time, but at the same time, customers are still not satisfied with their flight experiences. So, we have corralled an expert on the air travel industry to talk about these issues. My guest this hour is Terry Maxson, reporter for Airline Biz Blog for the Dallas Morning News. Welcome to the program, Terry. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, pretty good so far, but the day is young. Always have to leave a little room for things to happen. Let's start with the Southwest Airlines issue. I've never been on an airplane that suddenly lost cabin pressure, but I would imagine from the descriptions that it's a pretty scary experience. As I understand it, a crack opened in the skin of the aircraft. Why did that happen?
Well, there was a tear, apparently, along the fasteners that held what they called the lower lap joint, lower edge of the lap joint on the airplane. It was, of course, a surprise to everyone involved. It was a surprise to Boeing, which believed they had redesigned that part of the airplane for that model of airplane and had built a lot more strength into it and reliability.
This had happened. This isn't the first time that Boeing had had a problem with the 737 on this. As you mentioned, they did a redesign. How long ago was that?
Well, the this model, the 737, is what they call the classic. It's three sizes of airplanes: the 300, the 400, and the 500. That airplane started coming out of the factory in the early 1980s, made up a lot of the fleet of Southwest Airlines. Southwest Airlines flew nothing but that type. It developed over time that the number of cycles that an airplane went through, the takeoff and landings, was causing metal fatigue over a long period of time. And they came back with a modification for the early versions of the 737 Classic, as they call that model. And then in the early 90s, Boeing redesigned that airplane so that there would not be that problem, and they thought they'd resolved it. The airplanes that we're talking about were built between 1993 and 2000 with a new improved design. And it's safe to say it was a surprise to Boeing to find the problem that developed on the Southwest airplane this past Friday.
Yeah, that was the second story about this, really. I mean, you know, I guess since Southwest has been pretty aggressive with pricing, it was pretty easy for people to draw the conclusion off the initial news reports that they may have been cutting corners on things like inspections and so forth. But when Boeing came out and said, gosh, we thought there would be at least 20,000 more cycles before we saw anything like this, that rather took Southwest off the hook, didn't it?
When they make recommendations about when you should do an inspection, Boeing and the Federal Aviation Administration try to make it extremely conservative. So if they think the problem's going to start at this point in time, they back it up a little bit before that to build in even more safety. Paul Richter, the chief project engineer for the 737 Classic at Boeing, said on Tuesday that they had no inspection requirement for this area of the airplane because they just didn't think it would be a problem for a long time. They were developing, based upon analysis and testing, a recommendation that airplanes needed to start inspecting these lap joints at 60,000 cycles, 60,000 takeoff and landings. They had not yet put that out to the operators of the airplane, because airplanes had not reached that point. These airplanes, again, would be 15, let's say 11 to 18 years old, and had not reached that many cycles. As you noted, the Southwest airplane was less than 40,000 cycles, and for a problem developed at 39,700 some cycles that Boeing did not expect to have to even worry about until they got to 60,000 cycles, obviously that left them scrambling after this hole developed last Friday.
Southwest had to ground a lot of airplanes. I assume they've had to cancel some flights. And how has that affected them?
Fortunately, the decision to ground 79 airplanes came overnight between Friday and Saturday. Weekends tend to have fewer people flying, so. If you had to have a grounding, that would be a better time. 79 aircraft grounded. They did cancel 300 flights of, let's say, approximately 3,200 scheduled on Saturday, same on Sunday. Last estimate I heard was about 70 on Monday. Monday they have 3,400. What it looked like by looking at their schedule was that there was no particular part of the system that was overly hit. You know, there'd be five out of this airport, four out of this airport, 10 out of this airport, Southwest has a strategy of tending to have a high frequency of flights to the places where it flies, so that there'd be another flight coming along. Now, having said that, many, many people were inconvenienced. If you figure close to 700 flights canceled, easily 100 people per airplane, that would indicate that there were, 70,000 people at a minimum inconvenienced. But considering everything, it went fairly smoothly.
Well, I guess perhaps one thing that may have made this a little worse than, say, if it had happened 10 or 15 years ago is that flights are, there are a lot more people on planes these days. I mean, because the airlines have reduced the number of flights overall, and so that means that you've got a lot of full planes. So I would imagine that it was a little bit of a challenge to try to reseat all of those folks on other flights.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Southwest, as a rule, has not had as high a load factors or percentage of seats filled as other airlines, but they're coming up, and in most months, more than three out of every four flights, three out of four seats on every flight is filled, which means, of course, that at the peak periods, they're absolutely filled. On peak days, they're absolutely filled, and if you don't catch a flight if your flight is canceled, it takes a long time to work out that backlog. But although many people were inconvenienced, probably it was less of a fact than, say, if it was peak time on a Friday evening. They seem to have made the best of a bad situation.
The Southwest uses more, as I understand it, more of the 737 aircraft than any other airline. But other airlines use this plane. It's, as you mentioned, it's all over the place. You see a lot of them because it was a very successful design for Boeing. So, what does this mean for the rest of the Boeing fleet and for other airlines going forward?
Well, it doesn't seem to. It doesn't seem to affect as many airplanes in the United States as you might imagine. Strangely, this is one of those few cases where they've had to have emergency inspections affecting the later versions of an airplane model rather than the earlier versions. The earlier versions had already gone through discoveries of metal fatigue and remedies required for it, and major modifications to make sure those airplanes were safe. So this is one of those kind of strange things where it happened late in the cycle, and toward the end of the cycle, a new version of the Boeing 737, what they call the next generation, came on the market. Southwest took delivery of their first one in, I believe, 1997. So had they kept building that, this would have a greater effect. The Boeing estimates that there are 540 airplanes, Boeing 737 Classics, that are covered by their service bulletin that they've put out requiring emergency inspections. Of those 540 that eventually will need that inspection. Right now, there's 175 that have passed the threshold of cycles, 30,000 takeoff and landings, that they want inspected very quickly. Of those, 80 are in the United States. Almost all of those are flown by Southwest Airlines. Now, Alaska Airlines has some 737s, but they estimate only a couple of theirs were affected. U.S. Airways flies 737s of this model, but they're saying that that they're not covered by it. So, in the United States, it is largely a Southwest Airlines issue.
Yeah, most of us don't think a whole lot. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about how aircraft work, and in my case, for very good reasons. I don't want to think about it.
Yeah.
But if you do, I mean, the frame of an aircraft, when you think about it, wow. I mean, it has to absorb some awfully strong forces every time it takes off and lands. And yet, when I looked at the description of where this problem came from, they were talking about the issue being the pressurization and depressurization of the cabin as being the major stress issue. To me, when I think about it, it's unbelievable that these things can take off and land without flying to pieces in the first place. So maybe this shouldn't be as big a surprise as it seemed to be.
Well, you know, there's quite a science to designing an airplane, and what we find out is after a very well-designed airplane is put in the air for years and years and years and pressurized and depressurized and pressurized and depressurized, they find things they didn't know before. If you go back to the start of commercial jet airlines, we have the de Havilland Comet, which was launched in the early 1950s with great fanfare and brought a lot of prestige to de Havilland and to the airlines that flew it. And within a year or so, three of them essentially blew apart in the skies. They learned things about metal fatigue. In that case, I believe that they learned the lesson that about how to cut the metal, not to put square windows on metal airplanes that are flying at high altitude, that they should round it up, round it off. They learned things they did not know. Before that, airplanes flew at a lot lower altitude, and the issue of atmospheric pressure, it's a different issue at 37 and 41,000 feet than it is at 10,000, 15, or 20,000 feet. Unfortunately, a lot of the things that are discovered about aviation safety are discovered through incidents like what happened last Friday. They didn't know that the airplane would react that way, but it did.
We're talking about the airlines in general. Right now we're discussing kind of what happened with that Southwest plane and what that means for the Southwest fleet and why this incident happened and so forth. What do you think? We're also going to talk about how satisfied people are with airline safety, with the airlines in general, about their performance. A new report came out suggesting that there had been some improvements, things like planes arriving on time, not losing our luggage, and things like that. We're also going to talk about that. I've got an airline expert with me to answer your questions about air travel. Terry Maxson is a reporter. He writes the Airline Biz blog for the Dallas Morning News. 800-486-8655 is the number to join the program. 800-486-8655. You can send us an email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And there is a Kathy Dunn Facebook fan page. You can go there, leave a message on the wall, and we'll turn it into radio. So, lots of ways to get in touch with the program. If you have a question about air travel, if you have a comment about maybe an experience that you've had on an aircraft or with an airline, this would be a great time to talk about that. 800-486-8655, talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munden in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 23 minutes after 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about the airline industry today. My guest is Terry Maxson, a reporter. He writes the airline biz blog for the Dallas Morning News. And, Terry, we have callers waiting to join us. Let's go to Connie in Madison first. Connie,
hi.
Good morning.
I understand on these planes that there's a long seam along the long axis of the fuselage that's crossed by straps, so to speak, every 20 inches on the ones that have failed. And that design was improved so that those straps would be every 10 inches on later models, on later versions of the plane. I wonder if additional, whatever those are called, straps can be installed or now on those planes with the 20-inch span, or if that's something that can only be done at the time of manufacture, and as a result, the only thing we have left is to watch these planes that have the wider spacing every fewer cycles as opposed to the normal number of cycles for inspection.
Let me, if you don't mind me jumping in on this, the question was brought up with Mr. Richter of Boeing yesterday, and he said actually the earlier versions, prior to the ones that have had the recent problems, had the 10-inch spacing, and they went to 20-inch spacing onto these troubled ones. I'm not sure what it is on the next generation. Here's what he said. He said, frankly, the tear straps have little to do with the lap joint durability. They're more concerned if should cracks occur away from the lap joint, that the tear straps help ensure that any damage is controlled and limited to the amount of the area that might open up. You know, so that raises the question in my mind, would it have been a one-foot crack or a 2-foot crack instead of a 5-foot crack. Mr. Richter did not believe that it affected the length of the crack. That is more to keep more of the metal from stripping away. But he did not believe that it had any effect on whether or not the tear occurred. Take that as you will.
Connie, thanks for that call. Let's talk to Bill in Hudson next.
Yes, I'd like to know what percentage of parts are made in the United States and what part are in different countries, and their type of inspection. I've heard a lot was made overseas.
I'm afraid I do not know the answer to that. I do know that Boeing has in recent years tried to push more of the parts supplies to other countries and to suppliers other than Boeing. They want to share the risk. They want to, you know, have more participants in it. In the fuselage assembly, I'm guessing that is largely a U.S. deal. But understand, I'm speaking from ignorance, not from knowledge.
Bill, thanks for that call. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. Good pretty much anywhere you can hear the program, although I'm told that the number does not work from Australia. If you're there, you'll have to leave us an email, or send us an email, rather, talk at WPR. www.ncaa.org. Well, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, kind of the technical aspects of this, but so you're thinking of taking a trip on an airplane. How should you feel about this whole thing?
Well, not to be a unthinking optimist, but aviation safety is I think very good in the United States. Incidents like Friday's makes us question because it's the unknown. If Boeing and Southwest had no idea that this was about to happen, shouldn't we be concerned about the entire airplane? But you know, the fact of the matter is there are billions of seat miles being performed every month by major carriers with no problems. I don't know. I once noted that, for example, American Airlines, which was operating around 2,500 flights a day, if it were 99.99% safe, it would have an accident every 4 days. But in fact, U.S. airlines go years and years and years without an accident. There, all the time you're hearing about airplanes having to make emergency landings because smoke in the cabins or their instruments failed, or as in the case of the Southwest incident, a hole developed. But very, very few people are injured. Very, very people die, and the rate of deaths in airplane crashes is over the long period in a steady decline. Now, you can use that to say, well, we can relax, but we can't relax. And unfortunately, a lot of the things that the aviation industry learns about safety, they learn through bad experiences, such as the hole in the airplane. The trick then is to take what you learned and apply it to the situation, and then go back and make sure it doesn't happen anywhere else. And also try to extrapolate from it what that might mean for things on an airplane that weren't precisely there. The longitudinal lap joint that our previous caller referred to, they didn't expect to see cracking in there, certainly not at this point in an airplane's life. You just got to learn from what went wrong and make sure the next time nothing goes wrong.
It was in some ways then a fortunate incident. I mean, nobody got hurt, really, and we learned something. And so that's one on the plus column. I'd like to kind of change gears here and talk more in general about how customers feel about the airlines. There's a report on the satisfaction of travelers, which suggests that overall the industry has improved its performance on things like arriving on time, not losing my luggage, or denying me access to the plane, things like that. On the other hand, it appears that the number of complaints filed with the government is actually going up. So this on the surface, this seems like a contradiction. Could you maybe insert some clarity here?
I think airlines are one of the favorite things we like to complain about in life. There are so many things that can go wrong on an airline trip, from the time you try to find a parking space at the airport to you're waiting to go through the line of the TSA and deciding whether to check your bag or you carry it on and then have to throw away your contact lens solution because it's in 4-ounce bottle instead of a 3-ounce bottle. You don't like the airport prices. People are getting the board before you, and they get the good places to stow the overhead bags. There's no food. The flight attendants are tired and harried, and you want someone who's pleasant and happy all the time, and then you have to wait in the aisle for everybody to get off in front of you, and your bag is either late or it gets lost. There's just so many points on there that can be a point of aggravation. And most of our life is routine, and we can control it. But essentially, from the time you step into an airport, you lose control of your life. You can choose what flavor lifesavers to get at the shop, but beyond that, there's not much choice you've got. And I think that that loss of control and all the problems, ways things can go wrong, and the increasing number of people jostling with you for space on the airplane, it's just a recipe for aggravation. And so we try to mellow out and say, well, I can put up with it, but you know, it's tough for everybody concerned. Have I made it too angst sounding?
Hey, it's public radio. We can't be too angst sounding. There's no question that air travel has changed a lot over the last 15 years or so. The deregulation of the airline industry, which took place a long time before that, but has led to fewer number of carriers. The cost of fuel and some things has caused the airline industry, which was hemorrhaging cash after 9/11. Now the big spike in the cost of fuel, the prices have gone up. They reduced the number of flights. All sorts of things have happened that don't necessarily add up to the kind of service that people who maybe have traveled for years, maybe they got to expect certain things. I mean, you always used to get a meal on the plane. Well, now, you know, you might get a soda, or you might end up paying $4 for a bottle of water, and you might get a bag of peanuts, and probably not. I mean, there's just a lot of amenities that people were used to having on airplanes that they don't get anymore. We were also used to having flying on planes that didn't have a whole lot of people on them, and now just about every flight is right, you know, bursting at the seams.
You know, that's an interesting point, because there really has been a tremendous increase in number of people flying, far outstripping the number of airplanes out there to carry them. You may remember in 1992 there was a half-price war in the airline industry, and they talked about it being the summer of the clampets, because so many people who hadn't flown before were flying, and how airplanes were packed all summer, and they'd seen loads that they had never seen before. Well, the average winter flight is more crowded than the average summer flight was back in 1992. It really has increased. The Southwest Airlines, I don't think, probably had a month with more than a 70% load factor, 70% of their seats filled, until fairly recent in their history. And now it's been a number of years since they've had load factors anywhere used to what used to be their high points. It really is a difference. There were probably fewer and fewer people remember the way it used to be, where it was really an experience and you dressed up to go fly. That it didn't end exactly in 1978 when the airline industry was deregulated. That certainly put a stake through its heart. And so over time, we saw these changes. The load factors went up. The meals got not as good. They became snacks. To now, most airlines, there's nothing that you get back in coach unless you pay for it. It took a long time for all that to play out, but essentially, with airlines now, you get transportation, and depending on how much you remember the old days, that can make you unhappy. But if you just think of it as a way to move quickly without too much legroom and without excessive comfort from one point to another, if you think of the destination rather than the journey, it's not so bad.
Well, I can still remember my very first trip on an airplane from Chicago to Tampa, Florida, and it was, I believe, 1956. I remember that the flight attendant called me Sugar. I want to give the phone number again to make sure people remember it, and if they want to join with a maybe you've got a story about something that happened to you that really bothered you, you'd like to share that, or maybe you've got some kudos to hand out if you're a frequent traveler. 800-486-8655. How happy are you with air travel? 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. You can also leave a message on the wall of the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page, and the producers will put it on my screen, and I'll share it with the listening audience. The one thing it has been suggested, I believe this was in the Wall Street Journal, that the reason that complaints are up is that the Department of Transportation has made it easier to file complaints online. Does increased access to filing complaints have anything to do with the increase, do you think?
I think so, and I think if everybody, if they printed the number, the 800 number or the web address of the part of the Department of Transportation that takes complaints, they'd go way up. For example, Southwest Airlines generally is in the lower level of getting complaints. I'm going by memory, but I believe in 2010 they had the lowest rate of complaints. They rank them by number of complaints per 100,000 passengers. But I would say take any month and see how many complaints Southwest gets. I probably see more complaints on their Facebook page every day than goes on the DOT page. We have to presume that the knowledge of flyers is constant across the other across all the airlines, so that the complaint rate is a valid measurement of how happy passengers are with the airlines. In fact, the DOT complaint rates registered pretty much tracks what you get from consumer surveys and other sources of information about how happy airlines are with how happy passengers are with their airlines. It is interesting that one of the hardest things for me as a reporter is dealing with a reader's complaints, because let's say on an average day, Southwest Airlines or American Airlines will carry a couple hundred thousand passengers. Well, if only 1% of those people are unhappy, that's 2,000 or that's 200 unhappy people. And that'd be 2,000 unhappy people that day. And so, you'll get letters or calls saying, well, the airplane broke down and we didn't take off on time and I missed my connection and I did not get to the rehearsal dinner, and then coming back, the connection was messed up too, and I didn't get back for my niece's graduation. I feel very badly for them, but it would be a full-time job just dealing with all the messed up flights. Sometimes I feel like Stalin, who said one death was tragedy and a million deaths was a statistic. Airline industry has a hard time that they always have to work on to understand that every passenger's story and experience should be important to them.
We have lots of callers who have suddenly joined us, and we're going to take those calls in just a moment. But first we'll pause, and then we'll come back with more with Terry Maxson. He's a reporter. He writes the airline biz blog for the Dallas Morning News. He's with us until 10 o'clock this morning, and you can be too. Like I say, we'll take calls as soon as we come back. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:41. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Let me tell you what's coming up next hour. Next hour, we're going to talk about drug courts and what they're all about. They started in Florida in the late 1980s, and they've become quite popular. They're all over the country now, including here in Wisconsin. We're going to talk to a drug court judge from Eau Claire and another national expert on how they work, what they're for, what they're accomplishing, what the concerns are about drug courts. We'll do that after 10 o'clock this morning. This hour, we're talking about airline travel. We have a lot of people who want to talk to my guest, Terry Maxson. He's a reporter. He writes the airline biz blog for the Dallas Morning News. Let's start with Scott in La Crosse. Scott, thanks for joining us.
My question involves the outsourcing of maintenance, and my understanding is that several of the carriers now are for major overhauls, flying their jets down to a place like San Salvador in El Salvador, where that's carried out. And what I'd like to know is, in terms of the FAA's oversight of these facilities and what's actually going on down there or out there or over there, wherever they're doing the outsourced maintenance, how does that work and how good is it and how good could it possibly be?
Well, that's a good question, and here I'm going to push the envelopes of my ignorance. This question really came up when the Southwest jet lost part of its roof, and got a lot of suggestions that that perhaps this was because of substandard work done on during its heavy maintenance check. It had reached the point in its life where it had to go in March of 2010, where they basically strip down the airline and look everywhere and do all the tests that are required by the FAA, and freshen it up and check for anything they can. And the suggestion was that this was an airplane that Southwest had put down in El Salvador. In reality, the NTSB says the airplane was went through its heavy check at Southwest Airlines Dallas maintenance base. Going back to his question, there has been a lot of questions raised about this, particularly by labor groups who see a lot of the good jobs here in America being outsourced to lower cost facilities in places like El Salvador. The airlines are required to have people on site making sure the work is being done as required, but they have the paperwork requirements. They're supposed to be doing everything that at these other country stations as are done inside the United States. I cannot conclude for you how good or bad an idea it is. I know, however, that airlines are increasingly doing this. One exception is another airline that's in my backyard, American Airlines, which has made the decision to keep as much of its maintenance in-house, and so their heavy maintenance checks and most of its maintenance is done in-house, and it is at considerable cost to American Airlines compared to other carriers who have sent it to other repair stations and maintenance bases inside the United States and outside. So I'm sure the caller recognized I didn't really answer the question, but he's raised a concern that many have raised, and it's a very valid concern about whether or not the quality of work in these other stations is as good as it should be.
Scott, thanks for the question. Here's an email from John in Wausau. Talk of the Nation just did a show on this topic, and the expert they had on made the point that flights are on time more often now because the airlines are allowing for delay time in their scheduling. So while flights appear on time, they are actually just allowed more time. Well, I mean, either way, they're still on time, I guess.
Well, this goes back to when I think the DOT began keeping track of on-time statistics, requiring airlines to report it back in 1987. Then the complaint was that airlines had unrealistic schedules so that their flights would come up first in computer reservation system displays and would show them leaving at a certain time or getting to the other city at a certain time that bore little relation to reality. Then they started keeping the on-time statistics, and the airlines went in the other direction, which is, as the emailer suggested, building extra time into the schedules to make sure they are they're on time. You know, the average time in the schedule between Dallas and Houston is probably, let's say, an hour, but the actual flight time from lift off to set down is probably 35 minutes. It sounds nefarious for airlines to, be dishonest in their schedule times, but there is a disadvantage to them for putting extra time. It means that they're not scheduling their people and airplanes as productively as they could. They're putting the time in there to have reliability, and so they won't look bad. They do not want to have extra time. They wish that flights would leave always as quickly as possible, and that they could put that in the schedule. So, you know, it's misleading for them to do that, but it's to their disadvantage. It costs them money. Generally, delays they have to pay for it, and block times times from when the plane leaves the gate till it gets there is costly for them. Anything they could do to shorten it, they would.
Let's go next to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I have a couple of comments. One, my father spent his career working for Boeing as a maintenance training engineer. Basically, he was the one who went from airline to airline around the world, teaching their mechanics how to service aircraft. And I can tell you that he's gone now. And lucky for him, he's gone. Otherwise, he would. I mean, he's flipping over in his grave, I'm sure, at what the airline industry has degenerated to. I am old enough to remember what it was like. And yes, I remember when stewardesses, yes, they were stewardesses back then, were attractive and cheery and cared about good service. Now they're harried, they're overworked, they're underpaid. And at best, they are tired, and at worst, they are outright surly. The airport experience has deteriorated tremendously, I mean, in terms of just the experience of air travel as a whole, to the point where domestically, I refuse to fly. I would rather take 4 days to drive across the country than fly. Now, what bothers me about your guest is that he doesn't really sound to me like a reporter. He sounds like an industry flack, like he's an apologist for what's going on. And I find that kind of disturbing, because he's making excuses for the way things have gone. As far as I see it, the reason the airlines in this country get away with what they get away with compared to other countries, I mean, the airline service in other countries is much better, by the way. Even in third world countries, it's much better. The only place where it's worse maybe is Russia. But they get away with it because there's no competition. For example, the train service is not good enough. You can't take the train if you don't like the plane. If you want to go long distance, you pretty much have to fly. And they know that, and so they get away with murder. You can't, like in Europe, you can take a train, and you can, in fact, people have demonstrated that you can go faster from the north, from England to Marseille, from London to Marseille, by train than you can by plane.
Well, Bill, let me allow our guest a chance to respond. You've given him a lot to chew on. Thanks for the call.
Bill, you make some good points, and I realize I sound like an apologist, because maybe after covering a long time, you kind of realize, you come to conclusions about what's possible and what's not possible. Before deregulation, you had limits to entry. You essentially had guaranteed rates of return for airlines. They still lost money, but basically the Civil Aeronautics Board would hear, how much their costs were, and then set fares, help them set fares based upon that. And not too many of us flew. That was back in a period where women were largely required to quit working when they got married or before they got too old as flight attendants. It was a much different world, and deregulation cheapened the product. The trade off is we can all fly now, and it's not a very exhilarating experience. It's not a special experience to ride on an airplane. Maybe it's just the fact that I accept that's the way it is. I wish airlines treated their customers better, but I also realize we're probably getting what we're paying for.
We have an email from Mike in, well, let's say Mike in Superior, and he says, listening to your guest list the most common complaints about flying, crowding, and competition for overhead bins sounds familiar, but what I'm really satisfied with is the high confidence that I'm going to arrive alive. On my last trip to Ireland, Martina, the head flight attendant on the overnight Delta flight from JFK to Shannon, saved a woman's life two rows ahead of us. There were repeated overhead calls for a doctor on board, and getting no response, the flight attendant did CPR and brought the woman back. Very dramatic and very impressive.
Let me respond, and also go back to Bill's comments. We expect, I guess we have a right to expect that we arrive there safely in a reasonable amount of comfort, and that there are people there available, even going above and beyond, as that flight attendant do, to take care of things if they go wrong. But I don't know. Bill's right. There's no high speed trains in most of the country. Europe is a much more compact country. As you know, I live in Texas. It's the size of France, and the population densities are in places that are far apart. Houston from Dallas, Dallas to San Antonio. I don't know what we should expect from our airlines. Bill expects more, and we should require as much as we can get, but we got to pay for it.
I'd accept wider seats.
I'd like more room between seats.
Well, yeah, that'd be good. Let's talk to Tom and Sobieski next.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. I'm kind of reiterating what your second caller just talked about and the previous one about the maintenance on the plane's frontline, which is a PBS show, had a special on the maintenance and how it's being farmed out to companies that are basically signing off on stuff that they're supposed to do without doing it because they want the planes in the air so fast. Plus, they have uncertified mechanics that don't know what they're doing at these places, and the government is looking the other way. And the point is maybe we're not hearing about all the problems they're having with the planes because a lot of it's self-reported. And in that respect, in the hospital where I work, a sentinel event is a big thing. The government comes in if somebody dies or something, and they tear you apart. In the airline industry, nobody's really torn apart. Nobody's really fined enough to really make it people aware that maybe I could go out of business if I do this one more time.
All right, Tom, thanks for the call. I need to move on here because we're running out of time. Terry?
What he described, I think, is referred to pencil whipping, basically signing off on maintenance work or repair work that was not done properly or was not done at all. It is every airline has to guard against that. And going back to what I think a couple other callers said, are airlines better off having that in-house than a third party? Well, certainly they can keep a closer eye on it, but it also depends on the integrity of the in-house maintenance. FAA has been in a debate inside and under pressure from Congress to be less the friend of the airline, less the partner of the airline, and more the enforcer of the airline. And here, both American Airlines and Southwest Airlines got into trouble in 2008 on the very issue of the relationship with FAA and whether or not those airlines were doing what was required and whether the FAA was letting them to not do things as FAA requirements provided. I digress from his question, but this is a continuing point of tension in the airline industry, the whole maintenance issue, in-house
farmed out, FAA oversight, and it seems like we have a, I don't know if we call it new scandal, but we have new controversies that are erupting all the time, and it eventually hits, it seems, most airlines.
Got about 30 seconds here. Very quickly, the sustainability of air travel, is it? Yes or no?
Well, yeah, absolutely. We may see a continuing cheapening of the experience. One of the continuing problems is the airline industries over long term are losing money. They've lost more money than they've made since Orville and Wilbur. Somehow the industry has to be put on a firm financial footing. When you have, over the last 10 years, with tens of billions of dollars in losses, something's not working right.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Terry Maxson.
I've enjoyed
talking with you. Terry Maxson writes the Airline Biz blog for the Dallas Morning News. Chrissy Pease produced this hour of programming. Katie Mattson handled on-air production. Stick around. We have another hour of the Kathleen Dunn program to go. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.